You ever feel frightened at all at any time?
Well, I've read things and that and heard that people say that if you didn't feel, anybody who said they didn't feel frightened would be mad and either a fool or a liar, wouldn't they? Yes, I suppose, I don't know that I ever felt frightened in that way, because I was too dedicated a patriot. I'd come all that way, thrown up everything, and the finest patriots you can get are Englishmen who are living abroad. And so for that reason, I mean, at times I don't know, but I do remember one instance now that you asked me that I was in some place in France, we were moving, I was in billets, and I was in a room by myself, and I woke up in the night, I heard voices, I woke up, and I found that I was half hanging out of this dormer window, and in my sleep, I had got up with the nerves that I had, perhaps, got up as though I were climbing out of a dugout. Now, on several occasions, but one particular occasion, you know that we used to have mines where we would mine underneath, and that was done by the engineers. And I do remember on one occasion they were working in mine. I was talking to the mine office in charge, and I crawled with him along this mine, and I don't suppose it was more about, say, about 3 foot, 2 foot, six, 3 foot. Crawled right along this to the far end, and he said, "There, we're digging here, we're huddled there, you can hear the Germans, the other side also digging." And then I came back, well, if I were to do that today, and many people would be the same, I think they would have a sense of claustrophobia in doing it. But for, as I say, for some reason it didn't. Now, another thing was that I do remember a gunner officer coming along, and he said, "I've come up to spot the artillery thing," and he climbed out and stood on the edge of the trench. It was a thing, it was apparently front line there, and he stood there while he was spotting the thing, and I thought, well, I'm his host here, so out of politeness I got out and stood with him. But I knew that people had been shot on that spot, because it was they had snipers trained onto the thing. But I just did that with him, and then when he got in, I was very relieved to get in. But in one case now, we sent over a party of about 15 or 20 men, their faces black, to do a raid. And there were a couple of officers and some NCOs, and the rest were the ordinary Tommies who went over. And at a certain stage, we suddenly, the heavy barrage behind this thing, while they went over. It's interesting going over with the barrage, everything's whistling over you, just blotting ahead, and you're hoping that one doesn't fall short. But I was in the front line there, and suddenly, though, two things happened. First of all, a shell, the Germans started shelling for all they were worth and shelling that line. And down something came, thing, and it hit my tin helmet. Such a clang that it knocked it off. And I was picked up by my helmet, put it on again, and then 1 second after, another piece hit and knocked it off again. You can be sure I put it on quickly after that, because it only showed, if I hadn't put it on, the second thing, but that showed the value of the steel helmets. Then, in the morning, we found a strange thing just behind where I was standing, in the back of the trench, was a shell. It was one of our own shells. Now, that shell had hit a German shell, and it had turned it, and it came down and went straight in behind her, but it didn't explode. But it, I mean, it shows that those shells, when they're whistling through, sometimes they must hit each other. Because the artillery had incidentally had come up just behind our second line and were firing at point blank range. We had to keep under the trench lip, because they were firing straight across. But I only thought then, well, if that shell, it was our own shell, it could very well have burst in there.
Did you always feel that you would come out of the war alive?
No.
Did you ever think about
it? No. When I left India, I had a lot of nice books there, various things, and I think I gave everything away when I left India, because I lived on the frontier, northwest frontier, Peshawar, up near the Khyber Pass, and it was very hit and miss up that side. And we felt that in this war, in the war that had started then, that things were going to be pretty difficult. And I certainly had the idea, and I should think a lot of my friends did, that we wouldn't come through it. But we were more or less fatalists in that way. And another thing is that I was of a very religious turn of mind, so that it didn't bother me. That was I think one of the underlying things there.
Now, when you joined the RFC, where did you go for your initial training? Can you remember?
Well, we were all over. I finished up at Old Sarum, I remember. Oh, yes. I finished up at Old Sarum, and then we went to they called it the School of Navigation and Bomb Dropping. We christened it the School of Aggravation and Leaf Stopping, because I remember going there, and then I finished up, I was at Stonehenge, below there, Lark Hill or something. We used to every morning have to run up by Stonehenge and down again, which we hated. And then I finished up at Old Sarum, and from Old Sarum then we went over to France, and then owing to the German push there in that had started about February or something, we came back again and went up to Lim, and then went over again from Lim to so we were up nearer the front, you see.
How many hours was it during the course of your training before you went solo, and how many hours before you got shipped out to France?
When I went out, I learned to fly.
Yes.
But I went out as an observer.
Ah, yes.
I went out because I went to Reading for the training there, and there was such a shortage that they pulled us out and pushed us over to this other side, just for them. I learned with my pilot and that, and various pilots I had, I learned to fly because I didn't intend for the pilot to be killed. And incidentally, that's how I was in the last war too.
Mm-hmm.
So that in the last war, I was able, with somebody with me, to do a lot of flying. I was all through the Plymouth Blitz and everything, all that. But at that time, we used to reckon that the time that you had in France, our life there was 4 hours when I went over. Well, I had a lot more than 4 hours, so many poor people were shot down, perhaps in their first flight or something like that.
Now, I've heard it said that one of the big fears, of course, was fire. Did that ever bother you? Did you think about that at all?
No, I never thought of fire. I never thought of fire somehow. Until when I had this petrol all over me, I only thought, well, good thing it didn't catch fire. But reading one or two books since, where about their first war, where they went down in flames, well, we lost a lot of our friends, you see, then fire, but at the time I never thought so much of fire. As you know, we never had parachutes. The only people who had parachutes were the balloonists. And of course, we were strongly heavier than air people. They were the lighter than air, they were the observation balloons. And of course, when they were attacked, then they could jump out and go down by the parachute. If we anything happened to us, we hadn't a chance. I remember when after the First War, I came out from them, and I went back later on, but I came out and I joined Brunnermond up at Northwich, and somebody there said to me in the Brunnermond, they said, did you ever know anybody called Malcolm? And I said, yes, he was in my squadron. And they said, well, his father is chairman of the Salt Union. And later came, they said, would you, and then the father phoned me, Mr. Malcolm, he was chairman there. He phoned and said, will you come out to dinner? It's just ourselves. He said, only dinner jacket thing, and that I could think. I went over there and I met the family. Well, Malcolm was killed. He went down in flames. Now, I had a very difficult thing because they wanted to know. And I've had to write letters about my men who were killed and things like that. And also see people where my brother officers were killed. But I never believed in telling them anything that they would harrow them at all. So I just kept, I told them how he was killed instantaneously, that they went down in flames. That is one of the things that the hazards that you had to chance. As I say, I was fortunate in a way that we didn't have, we never had anything like that. But I can tell you one more interesting experience, and that was when we used to carry a 230-pound bomb slung underneath. Now those bombs, you put a detonator in, and then at the front they have a thing with vanes on. Now that while the bomb is being carried, the vane is prevented from turning. When you release the bomb, then of course the bomb drops, and when it's going down, the vane unwinds, and then the detonator is ready, and when it hits the ground, off it goes. Well, I remember coming back when our bomb that we got on that aircraft, it stuck, except the nose. It dropped down like that. And it was underneath. Couldn't get at it. So, in landing, the idea is, will it blow up? Will it? Fortunately, it stuck there. And taxied into the thing. Now, there was that bomb hanging there. And it got to be moved. Well, I don't know why, but I said, I'm not letting any of these men touch that. So I crawled underneath, and then I unwound this thing and took away this vane thing, and then with something I put it in and managed to gradually pull the detonator out. Now, detonators are very funny things. It's a small detonator out of a Mills bomb. Hit it with a hammer, it wouldn't go off. And yet I've known it to go off with the warmth of your hand. So that I do remember that incident. I hadn't thought of this before, but I remember when I was lying there and I gradually got this thing out, pulled it out, and then the bomb, of course, was safe. But that was the thing, you see, it was really, you might say somebody else should have done that, but I felt, no, it was my aircraft, it was my job to do it. Because, to start with, my pilot, I was senior to him. I was a senior officer then, it was just my job to do it.
Now, obviously you had some very harrowing experiences. What was the funniest incident that you can recall?
It's not a funny.
during yes. your training? Or
yes, I was trying to think that. Nothing. Now, I tell you, going the opposite way. I mentioned a few minutes ago that I had to go and see. I remember going over to somewhere like Shepherd's Bush to visit the parents of one of my brother officers who was killed on the Somme. And when I was talking to them, I happened to mention I'd been wounded at the same time, this was some month or two after, and I happened to mention to them that my mother had said to me this, she said on Sunday, this was the 3rd of October, she said on very strange, on Sunday afternoon, she said about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I felt something had happened. And she said, all I did was, she went outside, then I got on a bus, the only thing to do, and I went right to the other destination and back again. And after 2 or 3 hours I felt better. And she said, now the next day, you were wounded. I said, no, I was wounded at 3 o'clock on that Sunday afternoon and lying out there during those 3 hours. Well, that didn't mean, I just was interested in that. But these people said to me, oh, you believe in spiritualism, which I do not. And they said that their son comes to, they say he comes every night and stands there and says good night to us. Well, I didn't believe that, but I couldn't take away their comfort in it. So I had to more or less go along with that. I've never seen them since. And I didn't want to, because I was afraid that if they got that idea about me, and then I'd have to disabuse them of it. So I never said anything about it. But they get, and I think one amusing instance, I just thought that when we went to a cinema, there were about perhaps a dozen of us, Royal Flying Corps, we went to a cinema, theatre I should say, in Salisbury. And they were putting on a play, I think the play was called 3 Weeks, or something like that. And we couldn't help, we laughed, you see. And they seemed silly to us. And the audience objected, because we laughed. And the management asked us to leave, you see. So the dozen of us walked out. Might we have flew to France the next day. If those people had known it, they'd have felt sorry. But you do get funny things. I think again when I remember once flying over Bournemouth, and I was like a nigger, because I was looking over the side, and the oil was coming out the exhaust, and inhaling that, it made me sick. And so I was sick over the side, and I wondered what happened to the people down on the front of Bournemouth. But you do, you get some of those things that are amusing.
Now, you must have made some very good friends. Did it upset you dreadfully when they were killed or lost them?
No, the first friend I ever lost was when I was this young man. I remember his name now, Pollard Urquhart, when I was in Peshawar. The war just started, and he came into the bank where I was, and he said to me, here we are, I'm with the Kings. We're out here, I shall miss the war. And I'm fed up by him. But the next day, they went out into the up the Khyber Pass out there on some patrol thing, and they're attacked by some of the Afghans. And driven back, and he and a soldier were wounded. Anyhow, the people reformed and charged back, and they found that he had shot the soldier through the head and shot himself. because if he hadn't, and even then they found he'd all been cut up, you know, like Kipling says, when you're lying wounded on Afghanistan's plains and the women come out to cut up our remains. But that was, that rather shook me when I knew that was first. And in India, you did have, death was a very prevalent thing there. You died in the morning, you were buried in the same day. That's all was done there. Well, therefore, when I was over as a serving officer and there were these things, it was, you know, bitter, you're sorry, somebody being killed, great friend of yours, I had a good many good friends killed, you're sorry for them, you have to pack up their things and send them home and do that. But it's like playing the reveille after the last post at a funeral. You must keep going, and that is, I think, always a good thing. When you do get it, don't you, at the cenotaph after the last post, you get the reveille.
When the war finished, did you feel it was a terrific anticlimax? Did you feel unsettled?
Yes, when I came back after the war, I couldn't, I'd been starved there, as I say, a slice of bread a day and a little turnip soup, and I couldn't eat. Our family doctor said to the family, they said, don't bother about it. I didn't want food. I got so accustomed to being without. Then I was, through being in hospital, and lying there on my back and all that, I got, had stone in the kidney, and I was only 23 then, 23. I think it was 23 then, this was after I was wounded that time, I had stone in the kidney, and I don't know, I somehow felt after the war, that I don't say unsettled, but I felt that I was asked whether I wanted to go on flying. I said, yes, I do want to go on flying, but I got married just after that, and Brunemond had asked me, they said, you've been out in Japan before, will you go to Japan? So I went out to Japan there. As soon as I got to Japan, there was the trouble at a place called Shanak with the French, that is over near Turkey. And there were quite a few, about a dozen ex-service people, we cabled home to the War Office to say, should we come back again? So it shows that we were not... Incidentally, you see, I was in Japan where they had the earthquake there in 1923. And, of course, before this last war, I rejoined the Royal Air Force, so that when the last war ended, I went all through, I was in Coastal Command, I was out in India with Mountbatten's headquarters for years, 3 or 4 years, and on the whole, I should say, had a very adventurous life.
Now, when you came out of the after the First World War, when did you actually leave what was then presumably the RAF?
I should think I left, the war ended in November 11th, didn't it? I should think I must have left about the following April.
And you didn't go back into the service at all until just before?
I didn't go back into service. I went out to Japan with Brunemond, and 5 years later, when I came back, then I joined Unilever's, and I went to live in Brussels for a long while. And it was only after that, in the 30s, just some time before the war, a friend of mine, who was, he was a personal assistant to the Minister of Civil Aviation, was chatting to me. And he said about the RAF, have you ever thought of going back into the RAF? And I said, I wouldn't mind. And he said, I'll bring you the papers. And I filled the papers up. They're most exhausted. And I filled up these papers. And he said, I'll take them in. Well, it used to take about a year or 18 months for that to go through. You had to describe in that everything that you had done. And you might say, from the first time you'd ever worked or school, from your school days and what. Anyhow, I filled that up and sent it in. And to my surprise, two or three days later, I was up at Air Ministry. I couldn't make it out. Now, during the war, I happened to be see him once, and then I was in right away. And during the war, I happened to meet him, and I said, why Harry went through? Oh, he said, that was simple. He said, I pinned a slip on this, on your papers, to say, the minister would be glad of your attention to this matter. And he sent it over, that was Minister of the Navy, sent it over to the Air Ministry. Oh, the minister. I never knew the minister. The minister never knew me. So it was.
Well, you must have had an exciting time in the last war, too.
In the last war, the first thing that when I joined, I was in when it was in Coastal Command, and of course, my thing is I've always studied things like accountancy, legal matters, and all such things. And they sent me after, or a few months after the war started. I was, first of all, I was stationed at St. Athan. And then the war started, you see, and after the war started, I was sent to a school they had started for these young officers who were joining, or officers who had come back. And I was sent there for a course. To my surprise, I came out with 96% in every one of the 15 subjects. And I was back there as an instructor immediately. I stayed there a few months. And after a few months, and I got on quite all right. And then I said, no, I must get back to an airfield where I must say. So then I was down at Pembroke Dock. And then we had, incidentally, we had started a senior officer's course up at this place. It was Gerald's Cross at the time, and then it was moved to Newcastle. And then it kept coming down from to say that I was to go for this course. And I'd phone Air Ministry, and I knew the people there because they allowed me to bypass my group and Coastal Command to go direct Air Ministry. I knew that. And they'd say, there's a mistake, forget it. And this kept happening, and eventually my air officer commanding, when the thing came through, he said, this was awful, we've been all through the Blitz in Plymouth. He said, it'll do you good, Dukes. Go up there for it. And so I went up for the course. I stayed up for the course. There's about 3 weeks there. That was just the time the repulse was, and Japan coming in war. And so they and we had the examinations there, and there again we had about 15 examinations, and I got 100% in every one of them. And they said to me, do you want to stay as an instructor? I said, not on your life, I will not. And people couldn't understand that, but I had written that course myself. I'd written the whole course and the questions and all the answers. How could I do less than that? When I got back to Plymouth, I had word that because you know Japan and Japanese, I can speak Japanese with you, you must go out to India immediately.